Well, g'day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Bob Carr, the longest serving Premier of New South Wales, who also served as Foreign Minister in the Gillard government. Bob is a former journalist who has published several books touching on his love of literature, Australian history, and his time in politics. We covered a variety of subjects in our chat, some of those like immigration and foreign policy, where I thought there is a surprising overlap with those who have a national conservative perspective. On others like trade policy, as you will see, he was far less interested in discussing. We also covered China, J.D. Vance's recent speech, his views on Make America Healthy Again, and who he thinks are the best writers and most well-read politicians in Australia today, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome Bob Carr to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Pleasure to be talking to you about these issues.
Yeah, I've lots to talk about. You, back in 2000, famously said that Sydney was full. We're 25 years later and Sydney is fuller. Brisbane and Melbourne are bursting at the seams. You've been involved around and in government for a long time. Why has it been so difficult to change public policy on immigration?
I think we've got a model of economic growth over-reliant on the building of apartments. That's essentially it, and on the infrastructure that's required. I was talking to someone from Sydney Water the other day, and they have a massive bill for increased infrastructure just driven by the rate of population growth. So we've added, I think I'm right in saying, 1 million people to the country's population over 3 years. We're adding something equivalent to the population of Canberra every year. We're inviting public backlash, and we're putting enormous pressure on infrastructure in the state's three biggest cities. And a lot of the politics, I think of the politics, the changes of government in Victoria, a lot of it has been driven by the pressures of the population growth that Victorian premiers have told us is altogether good, as if there was some pennant to be awarded with them overtaking Sydney. The people of Sydney couldn't care less that Melbourne ended up with a bigger population. They thought it offered them some relief.
Yeah. A large non-discriminatory immigration program combined with free trade, open capital markets, deregulation of the labour market has been at the heart of the Hawke-Keating-Howard bipartisan consensus when it comes to economic policy. It replaced the so-called Australia settlement. Do you think that policy framework, that consensus, is still working?
In large measure, it is. I think you'd need to balance that list of achievements of the Hawke-Keating era by including occupational superannuation, which is a very creative achievement. We couldn't imagine Australia without it. It's a retirement incomes plan for this country that has built up a huge pool of investment, which is good in itself, but it's given more retirement security that has added to the fairness of our society. That's the first thing. And we've continued to adhere, and the Conservative Party's underlined this, to a universal healthcare system, although in contrast with Britain's National Health Scheme and perhaps some of the European schemes, we've got a big private sector contribution to our hospital system. And the very best of our hospital systems is when you've got a private and a public one working together, sharing a campus. So I'd add those, the protection of universal compulsory health care and occupational superannuation, to the list of the policies that came out of the reform of the 80s. They're accepted by the conservative side of politics, and they do tilt things towards a fairer country than the list of pro-market reforms might suggest if standing on their own, you observe them.
Yeah, so
there are ways in which the Australian political scene has ameliorated some of the harsher aspects of unregulated capitalism and the like. But I think it's true to say, like, so-called Washington consensus, which embodied those things, open free markets, capital markets, foreign investment, is being called into question since at least the Trump administration and more generally. Do you have a problem with the term the Washington consensus? Do you think that there is a need for more deeper thinking on things like trade and open capital markets to address some of the kind of populist grievances that are existing globally?
I don't think we in Australia, I'm just choosing the words carefully as I'm thinking out loud, can really complain about that consensus, because from the lowering of trade barriers, we've done very well. We're a net beneficiary from the lowering of trade barriers, and we couldn't have gone on running that heavily subsidized car industry, producing a mere 500,000 vehicles a year, up against the massive output from the assembly lines in South Korea and Japan. That was over in the 90s. Hawke Keating and then Hewson Howard recognized the reality. We couldn't have continued with that model. So I say to people who oppose free trade, Australia has benefited from the lowering of trade barriers, being able to get our lamb into the United States, our beef into South Korea and Japan. These were historic achievements by trade ministers from both sides of politics. Australia is just dependent on foreign capital inflows. It's only with the growth of occupational superannuation that we've begun to export capital, and reducing foreign investment in Australia, while always reserving the capacity of a treasurer to say no in the national interest, as treasurers have done, Peter Costello, for example, famously, and Wayne Swan. Wayne Swan rejected a bid by Singapore to take over the Australian Stock Exchange. And there's no gain for Australia in that happening. He was right to reject it. Costello made a big decision on Woodside. I forget the details. So you have got a capacity for a treasurer to move in the national interest. We're not at the mercy of foreign predators. Labor governments and coalition governments made a decision that a big Chinese multilateral, Huawei, couldn't run our national communications network. And while I've got criticisms with the undiplomatic way that was processed, I still don't disagree with the decision.
Okay. So, let's handle each of the sort of components in terms, because trade is somewhat different to open capital market flows and foreign direct investment and the like. One of the key differences for the Trump agenda has been its approach to trade. They've now putting tariff barriers not only on China, but on a broad-based tariff ring around the United States on friends and allies and, competitors alike. Do you think our trade agreement with China, where we allow effectively 100% manufacturing goods to enter into our country duty-free, should continue in its current form?
Well, it gives Australians, and conservatives would be the first to make this point, cheaper goods in their supermarkets and hardware stores and elsewhere. We don't produce cheap manufactured goods. We don't produce running shoes. It'd be a waste of time to do that. A horrific waste of our resources to do that basic assembly line manufacturing. But bear in mind, China is getting out of it. China's getting out of it. The south of China used to be the biggest location of shoe manufacturing in the world. It's now the biggest location of drones. China, even in its authoritarian manner, is going around closing down old-fashioned manufacturing. They're getting out of it faster than we got out of it, even at the cost of high unemployment in the Rust Belt provinces like Liaoning in North China, where unemployment is high, precisely because they're getting out of the very basic manufacturing. All that manufacturing will end up going to, I'm guessing here, but where it's filled up the coffers of Vietnam and Myanmar, it'll be Bangladesh, in the end, I suppose it's worth looking out 50 years. It's possible to imagine, and The Economist magazine, I think, has done this from time to time, such manufacturing ending up in sub-Saharan Africa. This is a process that has been rolling out since the industrialization of Japan.
Isn't there a problem, though? Like, I accept we can all get cheaper goods if we drop all our tariff barriers, but aren't there some other liabilities which build up, both social and economic liabilities which build up, because we lack sovereign capacity to produce things? And I'm not just talking about national security tanks and whatever we need, like drones, for example, but just that broad-based industrial ecosystem. So if we need to produce syringes or a hammer and a nail or a knife and a fork or all that stuff, we can't do so. We're at the mercy of, completely at the mercy of global markets. Doesn't there need to be a little bit more prudence about this, you know, zero tariffs is the goal above all in our approach to trade?
I don't think anyone's pushing an abandonment of industry policy where we need it for national security, like where there's no one, no corporation from China, quite possibly, or Russia for that matter, is going to get near Australian infrastructure. So that's a foreign investment argument. We're entitled to say there's too much foreign activity in our real estate market, forcing up the price of Australians who want to buy their first homes. That sort of intervention, and Australian states have pursued it, is altogether legitimate. But if you were to go back to the protectionist policies of old, then you'd be reducing Australian living standards, because you'd be saying to some working class family where every dollar counts and the pressure of their mortgages is acute, well, we've got a national industry development policy that's going to oblige you to pay more for stuff you get from Bunnings or from one of the supermarkets. And I think the old argument that Australian free traders held to at the turn of the century, great conservatives like George Reed and others, was that if you get your revenue from tariffs, then that is a tax burden on working class families who are struggling to buy goods and who buy a lot of goods that are imported. That was the argument that free traders like the great George Reed, Prime Minister of Australia, Premier of New South Wales in the Federation era, put forward. That was the very basis of the free trade argument. But I don't think it's legitimate. The Australian government has made decisions when it comes to out of the COVID crisis, when it comes to our capacity, you say sovereign capacity, to produce goods we might need in a crisis and not be dependent on imports. But it's hard to see our performance in the event of a war being handicapped by those considerations. It's more likely to be handicapped by our capacity to mobilize submarines and drones and missiles.
Yeah, I mean, there's during the Biden administration, and we tend to mirror what happens in the States, they did start re-engaging in more aggressive industry policy in particular sectors, high whiz-bang sectors like critical minerals and, you know, quantum computing and the like, under the so-called like high walls, small yard sort of doctrine, where they'll just focus on particular things that are important of national security, but let the rest of it effectively be open to global markets. I mean, I think that at some level you need a broader based ecosystem to produce goods, because that's where new innovations comes. You know, you're a student of American history. It was the arsenal of democracy in Detroit that converted cars into tanks and was able to produce all the other things that were needed to defeat the Nazis and the rest of them, right? So isn't that what's missing? You simply can't silo off particular things that might be useful for national security without building up a more broad-based industrial capacity.
Yeah, but what I want is a recognition here that were we to recommence making in Australia the basic stuff that we used to make, but only behind high tariff walls, if we were to attempt to bring that back, we'd be putting a huge tax burden on the very Australians who could least afford to pay it. So one of the big gains, if you looked at what a working class family has had to pay for school clothes over 30 years, the real cost of school uniforms, the runners and the shorts and the T-shirts and the rest, the real cost of that has fallen. It's fallen. So that's relief on family budgets. It's fallen because we've stopped kidding ourselves that in the Hunter Valley we can have clothes manufacturing and textile manufacturing as if we were a third world economy. Lettuce imported from overseas, it might come from Fiji, might come from China, but China's getting out of that. China's getting out of that. It'll come from, more likely to come from Vietnam than China. But that has meant a net gain in the living standards of Australian families. Now there are a pile of Productivity Commission reports that high, and I think Australians know that. We used to make cars, but we got into trouble when the tariff levels reached 50-55%, and then on top of that, when there were still imports from South Korea and Japan coming in, they were still able to leap a 57% tariff barrier. When that was making the ordinary family vehicle colossally expensive. So people had a preference for better cars, more resilient cars, and they were being provided by South Korea and Japan, and they were leaping over stout tariff walls, tariff levels of 57%. And then the Australian government in the 70s would put on quantitative restrictions that actually just limits the number of foreign vehicles that could come in. We cannot go back to those days because you'd be asking Australian families to pay an absolute fortune in real terms for clapped out quality that couldn't get the competitive advantage that a South Korean assembly line producing 30 million cars a year can easily capture. When we've got assembly lines, we used to have four separate manufacturers sharing an annual market of only 500,000 cars. So with the competitive pressure, the industry just fell over.
So there's two points, right? There's the national security component and there's the economic cost component. And you mentioned, oh, we get our socks from China. But if there was ever, doesn't this zero tariff policy setting assume peace, permanent peace? Even if you need to get your sock, you know, in a war, troops need socks, right? They need shoelaces. You can't just conjure that up from scratch. And if you need to boot it up.
Look, if national conservatism is resting its argument on telling Australian households, and the Productivity Commission would expose this, and the public would end up understanding pretty quickly that this is the price path we're on, we need to have a socks and a button industry in Australia. It's a crucial national security. It'll only happen with tariffs of 100-200% to get those factories back in the Hunter Valley and Geelong producing socks and buttons. But you're all going to be paying markedly more when you try to dress your kids for the school year. I don't think it would work. Next war is not going to be won because we run the danger, like the Confederacy in the Civil War, of not having shoe factories in Massachusetts. Being able to shoe the population of the North. That's not going to be a consideration. Let's get back to the main game.
Right. Yeah.
What can national conservatism say that's new and fresh that can transform the conservative critique? Here's a challenge for it that I would lay down. What are you going to do, say, about the size of government? Is the Musk agenda in tackling the formidable task of reducing the imperial scale of the public sector in Washington the essence of what national conservatism presents, or is national conservatism going to embrace that part of Thatcherism, Reaganism that says the government's not the friend, it's the enemy. The government sector is getting up to 40% total spending, which is where it is in France and Germany. We're going to wind it back. That's what I'm interested in.
Bob, I think people use that term conservatism when they actually mean anti-Marxist liberalism. And that's what we've been dealing with on the right since the 1980s. And when you talk about, you know, poo-pooing the idea of tariffs, well, people you admire and I admire, presidents, Abraham Lincoln, the Republican Party in the United States was one of its core planks was a high tariff wall. Theodore Roosevelt said, thank God I'm not a free trader. And it was people like Woodrow Wilson that cut the tariffs but introduced income tax, first peacetime income tax in the United States. So what you say about the cost, the ideal scenario would be you have a, you know, you have a tariff wall, so you encourage production inside Australia, but you reduce the cost of doing business here and the tax, direct tax rate.
You can't do that. So what capacity have governments got to reduce the cost of doing business? What capacity? Mm-hmm. I've yet to see it. I've yet to see it. There's a challenge. Produce the 5-point plan for doing that. But in the meantime, one of the biggest contributions to our cost, to our cost of living consideration, is locking out cheap but reliable imports. So go for a walk through a Bunnings store and say, look, that was made in Bangladesh. That was made in China. That's come from, I don't know what other country you'd pick, but well, we're going to put a tariff on that so we can start producing that in Australia. All you're doing is saying we are going to increase the cost of living, and it's very hard for governments with other policy instruments to offset that.
And yet, Bob, in the US, that's exactly, the Trump administration is imposing a tariff wall. He cites McKinley, he cites other as being part of the Republican tradition, as it was until, you know, very, very late in the piece, basically the 70s, when the Republican Party started to be more what I would describe as liberal, really. Not liberal in the classic British sense, not the sense that's used in modern American politics. And people like George Reed, you cite and call conservatives, they were liberals in the British liberal tradition. They weren't conservatives in the Disraeli tradition, who was much more skeptical about trade and other matters. So that's the National Conservatives is much more like the traditional Israeli type conservative that I don't think has really existed.
Here's my challenge. You persuade the conservative leadership in Australia to say, look, tariffs have been reduced. John Howard did it. When Hawke and Keating did it, they were supported by the then Liberal leader, John Hewson. We opted to open up the car market. We all got cheaper cars, and there are more jobs. There are more jobs in the maintenance and the retail activity because we've got a bigger car market. More people, you've got denser car ownership because we've got cheaper vehicles, and you've got more jobs than you had in when vehicle manufacturing took place in Australia at the Leyland site up till 1974, at the Pagewood site up to 1980, and those sites in Adelaide and Victoria, Geelong. There are more jobs now in the vehicle sector.
Yeah, but they're in service and distribution. 80%
They weren't there before. They weren't there before. It was only with the boost in car ownership made possible because we admitted Japanese and South Korean. The Chinese had no influence on this. In this era, they weren't exporting vehicles. But there are simply more jobs. Now, we've had this argument. The argument is over. Both sides accept it. Peter Dutton would not permit his shadow treasurer to contemplate a program of increased tariffs.
I know them. I know how they think. In my way of thinking, they're very much like the Cobden Bright British liberals of the late 19th century.
You got too many historical references. They are not a help to where we find ourselves now. And there's no relevance now. The industry policies of the United States, for God's sake, in the second half of the 19th century, when the Republican Party was quite corruptly handing out tariff protection to its rogue capitalist backers, is not relevant anymore. In increasing tariffs on steel, Trump disadvantaged the American steel industry and American manufacturing because it no longer had access to cheap component parts. They became more expensive. And as American commentators keep lecturing us, keep reminding us, it's impossible to identify where an iPhone is manufactured. It really doesn't deserve to be considered an output of China. There's a huge mix. There are complicated supply chains. And Trump is just returning to policies that render America an expensive place, not a competitive place, in which to invest in manufacturing. Can we move on to other aspects? I just think, I just think I think you've dug yourself in arguing for increased tariffs. It's not relevant. It's not relevant to Australia, which is an open trading economy and has done well because we've made ourselves that. We've got to get our products into other markets. We are an exporter more than the United States. We're an exporter, and we benefit from agreements that bring down, and we ought to be bring down barriers. And we've got to be terrified. But let's talk about other aspects of the Trump agenda.
At the Alliance of Responsible Citizens meeting in London, there was a debate between Tony Abbott and Orrin Cass and others on free trade. So it is, and actually they did one of those audience surveys where they said, who's in favor of free trade? 70% at the beginning. At the end of that, like that meeting, after the debate, it was changed to 47% were against it and 46% were in favor. So I'm just letting you know, it's not like a dead issue. It's actually very much being discussed. Moving on to other issues, though, are you still positive and optimistic, which is your favorite line, about the Australian-China relationship?
Well, it's going to be interesting now. Trump is saying he stands for protectionism. His protectionism means that China can't export its products to the United States. They'll dump them in other markets. So pressure falls on us. It's already happened in the glass industry. If China can't get its glass into the United States and give American industry and American consumers access to competitively priced glass, less expensive than that produced in the US, it comes here. It comes here. And what are we going to do? Do what countries did in the recession, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which plunged the world into a deeper economic decline. We overnight in Australia, under the Scullin Labor government, were introducing tariffs of 50, 70%. It just deepened the recession. So I think we're going to be, to return to your question, we're going to have more to talk about it with China. And by the way, don't pretend that China's disadvantaged by the Trump agenda. China has overnight got something to talk about with the Europeans because it stands on side with them when it comes to open markets. I think that China's got a long way to go, of course, because in the last few years under Xi, they've taken a decidedly unfriendly approach to the private sector. It seems they're now trying very quickly to reverse that. But a policy posture once struck is very hard to reverse. And Western investors would regard China as uninvestable. And that is a big obligation on China to prove they're wrong by actually showing that foreign investment in China can again make a profit and feel secure. But they've got a long way to go to do that, given the shift in their policy in recent years.
Yeah. Do you think the Australian political class has blamed Xi Jinping, or used him as an excuse for getting the policy settings on China wrong, when really it's a structural issue and China was always heading more or less in this particular direction?
No. Chinese history is about a cycle of dynasties and a cycle of emperors within each dynasty, and policies can change. Deng Xiaoping was a radical reversal. He was the greatest revolutionary of the 20th century in introducing China to capitalism. He could give national conservatism a few big lessons. No national conservative can rival his achievements in introducing ownership of land for farmers, dumping the notion of collectivization of agriculture, enable the ownership of homes, enabling private ownership of urban businesses. I spoke to someone who claims he got the first license for a privately owned restaurant in Beijing. This has been the triumph of capitalism is that China, after the disaster of Maoism, opted to take the capitalist path. We've just got to accept that China's taken an authoritarian direction under this, I was going to say this emperor, under this president, but you've got to maintain the relationship because there is plenty to talk about, and it's an investment in a day when Chinese economic policies could change and it could veer in the direction of political reform.
Yeah, I spent 15 years up there. I have a bit more of a skeptical view of Deng Xiaoping and a whole lot of these other guys in that time. But let's talk about the sort of I like to say when people are talking about China, you're not allowed to use the word engagement because it helps them think about what precisely the nature of the relationship should be like. You got it into a little bit of, courted a little of controversy due to your role with the Australian-China Relations Institute. But, you know, there were other liberal MPs, well, ministers. You know, Alexander Downer went to work for Huawei. Andrew Robb went to work for Landbridge. And the former ambassador to China went to work for various Chinese controlled or owned entities. Do you think that there should be greater restrictions on that, or how can those type of controversies be avoided in future?
Well, I've never worked for a Chinese business. I've never been on the board, so let me make that clear. I ran the Australia-China Relations Institute. It was set up at a meeting at UTS where Julie Bishop gave the speech where she launched it. The Australia-China relationship should legitimately be subjected to study. And under James Lawrenson, it's the director who replaced me, and all its research work is easily accessible. It's been academically rigorous. The relationship should be studied. It's a bit absurd to think that you can't touch and examine the relationship between Australia and China because we've got different, radically different political systems. The Australian government could pass a law that says no former minister in an Australian government could sit on the board of a foreign company. You could do that if you want to, but I don't think you can codify everything. Mm. And as long as there's scrutiny, so be it. I mean, more important than whether Alexander Downer was on the board of Huawei, I'd forgotten that he was. More important than that is the decision taken by a Labor government, one that I was part of, to exclude Huawei from tendering to supply equipment to our national broadband system, and a decision made under the coalition government to complete that ban. I think the first decision was about the supply of equipment. That was under Gillard, and I came in a few months after it was made and accepting that policy. And I think in the last days of Malcolm Turnbull, the policy was to exclude them from any involvement in the national broadband network. And I supported that, although I disagreed with the undiplomatic way it was trumpeted by the government. Mm. I thought we could do it the way Japan and New Zealand did and not embark on the notion that somehow it was our job as Australia to troll Huawei. I mean, if the Chinese had contemplated anything like that directed at BHP, we would have regarded it as a deeply unfriendly act. Mm. For God's sake, we ought to have the diplomatic skills to achieve our goal, not admitting a Chinese multinational to any say in our national communication system, but do it in a way mature and diplomatic that keeps the relationship alive and doesn't suggest to them that we're only doing this to impress the Americans, which is the impression given at the time.
Yeah. You've, at least in my impression, always had certainly had a very educated view on foreign policy, unlike many others that have been involved in federal politics, but you also had a realist streak. And, you know, you haven't got caught up in the emotional stuff of the day, as the way that democracies can get quite worked up on foreign policy issues. So you've been skeptical of many of the US-led interventions over the last 30 years. While you may not like him personally, isn't a reappraisal of the traditional US approach under Trump warranted? Shouldn't you welcome that at some level?
Yeah, I did. And I think I'm right. It's easily checked when I said in a tweet that he deserved to be taken seriously about the words he chose in his inaugural on this very subject. And I said to someone today, a journalist, that I think we've overlooked the weariness of a lot of America at the failed interventions, the so-called forever wars. Iraq is a very good example, but so is Afghanistan. Going in full-bodied to an endless war in Afghanistan instead of going in, wiping out al-Qaeda, and then retreating. I can't believe that with so little examination, we've been forced to accept that after 20 years of involvement, Australia there is the biggest non-NATO contributor, I think, the Taliban returned unhurt, unharmed to total control of the country. So Trump is right about that, and he's got an instinct that if fleshed out, could be very useful, and that is, let's relegate this great cliche of American foreign policy making, foreign intervention, military intervention. If anything goes wrong, all of a sudden talking about an expeditionary force. It was there with Hillary Clinton, a civil war in Syria, and she's saying, let's send a force in. And the Joint Chiefs resisted that notion, and I think they forced an admission that if America was going to walk into this Syrian civil war, can you believe it? All those competing militia, it would need to send in 100,000 troops to achieve what? I said to Henry Kissinger in one conversation, I said, Henry, you're saying the Obama administration is wrong on Syria. I said, who would you support? What would you do with Syria? He said to me, and it's very revealing, he said to me, I pick a side and back it. Well, that's pretty worrying, because you might have a committee of a dozen people that presents itself in Ankara or somewhere else as a voice for democratic Syrian opinion, but they might have no support on the ground whatsoever. And if you gave them any weapons, they'd end up in the hands of jihadists. You look at the interesting group that's taken over Syria now, that indicates, basically confirmed the sheer difficulty the West would have faced in deciding to, in Kissinger's words, pick a side and go in. I'll just complete the point with one example, because you would love it. John McCain, I'm talking to him as Australian Foreign Minister in the Capitol building. He's got an office with Goldwater memorabilia, and you'd acknowledge how important Goldwater was in the evolution of modern American conservatism. McCain said to me quite wryly, he said, yes, referring to Goldwater's candidacy in 1964 and his in 2000, he said, they 2008, he said, they like us from Arizona, but they don't elect us president. And I said, he was criticizing the Obama administration on Syria. And I said, I was speaking respectfully. I didn't use the cliche term with respect, but I said politely, what would you do? And he said, I'd do whatever Ronald Reagan would have done. He said, that's what we always say around here. So yeah. I think Trump has definitely got something there in appearing to cast aside this cliche of military intervention as the answer to any foreign entanglement. Surely that the sacrifices made in those Great Lakes states, all of which Trump won in the last election, had one factor in it, and there's been polling that suggested this. Those populations had contributed disproportionately with their sons and daughters, to American expeditionary forces in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, and we take it a bit for granted. On the Australian side, there's been quite the reckoning at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade about how, by really any objective measure over the last 30 years, all these foreign interventions, Libya and Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq and all the rest of it, it's hard to argue that they've resulted in a net gain overall for security, prestige of Australia, United States and everything else, right? So there does need to be a reassessment about how we got those things wrong.
I agree. Trump is challenging that. How he follows through, if Ms. Gabbard is going to deliver that in her role, and she's been a critic of the forever wars, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. It'll be interesting to see how the so-called deep state reacts to a president who said, I mean, if he follows through on it, and America is capable of allowing civil wars on the globe to be fought out and achieve their own equilibrium rather than doing what Bush would have done, then it will represent a bit of fresh thinking. Now, Marco Rubio gave a speech where he actually said, we live in a multipolar world and we need to work with a group of other nations, of other powers. It's no longer the unipolar moment. And if this represents a step around the neurotic focus on American primacy, everything seen as a threat to American primacy, if they're stepping away from that, then it would be healthy.
It's you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard and I was in the deep state. I was reading about the 70s, the Whitlam era, the other day, and it just I was surprised for somebody who wasn't there or alive at the time, just how paranoid they were about the CIA and US influence operations in Australia. But it got me thinking, the attitude on the right in some areas is somewhat similar. I mean, Tucker Carlson can sound a bit like Jim Cairns when he's talking about the CIA. What's your attitude towards those institutions, the CIA and US foreign influence operations generally today?
Well, you've got to say that every state in the world, every nation state, has a first a counterinsurgency or counterespionage arm. In America, it's a function of the FBI, and also a foreign secret service. In America, the CIA. The CIA regarded itself as the brain of America at one stage, perhaps in the 1950s, 1960s. Yet critical evaluations of its contribution have shown that its great initiatives rarely worked out well. It's been a litany of failure. Iraq being a big, relatively recent example of that. I think Trump, if he has a wary approach to what's fed to him from America's 16 or so security agencies, it would be a good thing. You see, they can get things wrong. They can get things right. But it would be a sign of healthy statesmanship. And he might be capable of it in his own somewhat mad way of treating them with more skepticism. If you look at the evidence they were serving up, and they agreed to serve up under political pressure about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, you've got a pretty powerful warning about how America can pay a whopping price for flawed, muddled intelligence.
Yeah. It seems to me that his appointments...
I better say to clear myself that there's been times when intelligence has been strikingly good. In the lead-up to the 2023 invasion of Ukraine, American intelligence was getting it consistently right. Russia was preparing an invasion.
It seems to me some of his appointments, at the very least, are an effort to restore trust in those agencies by appointing skeptics, known skeptics of them, so that the public can at least think, oh, well, this person is coming at it with fresh eyes, right? Moving to a different topic, J.D. Vance, in his speech in Munich, said that the greatest threat to Europe actually came from within. Do you share that view? And what do you believe are the greatest threats Australia faces today?
I think the greatest threat we face, to take the last question first, is declining productivity. You don't have higher living standards without rising productivity. We are becoming overregulated. That's part of the contribution to unimpressive productivity performance. We respond to every problem, problems in aged care, for example, with a new raft of regulations that get people in knots. And in our school system, teachers have to spend an awful lot of time with plans. Let's just get on with classroom classroom fireworks. I heard about a brilliant maths teacher at a Sydney school recently to boys' school, a Catholic boys' school, boys want to be in this maths teacher's class because he galvanizes the teaching of mathematics. But I just hope we get videos into those classrooms and learn from it if we're going to get kids to do so-called STEM subjects. But I think there's, I just fear for this country's economic resilience. If in the 2030s we're struggling with this enormous budget for these AUKUS subs, although I don't think we're ever going to get them, and the huge cost of NDIS, even though Bill Shorten's worked heroically to contain its spread, plus the effect of the aging of the population, that I think is Australia's greatest threat. Because if we don't get rising productivity and economic growth above that which they're getting in Europe, the sclerotic economies of Europe at the present time, we're not going to be able to afford the rockets and the drones and the well-serviced submarines. I hope we revert to the French ones before long, that maintain, protect, safeguard our sovereignty.
Just on his speech generally to Europe.
I think it was appalling. I think it was appalling to say America's glory is its alliance system. You've got countries putting up their hands to be part of it. China has got nothing like it. Russia, nothing like it. And at the heart of the alliance system is the NATO alliance, this notion of transatlanticism. You should treat the 20 or 25 members of NATO with courtesy and consideration. To go there and say to Germany, for example, remember how Obama cultivated his relationship with Angela Merkel? He said, she's been my closest partner. Germany's our most valuable ally. You've got J.D. Vance refused to meet the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany and meet instead the leader, I understand, of the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, the populist challenger. To the current.
What about his German warnings on immigration and free speech?
It's none of his business. It's none of his effing business. John Foster Dulles would not have gone to the Europeans and said, "I see that the British Labour Party is polling well. There'll be problems for us if they're ever admitted to government." America was nurturing this alliance system because it gave them a colossal edge over the wretched old Soviet Union, which only had slave states in its alliance system, Comintern, or whatever it was called at the time. No, I mean, to treat allies with disrespect and start commenting on their internal affairs, it's up to those countries to respond to concerns, many of them legitimate, about the level and the nature of immigration. It's none of J.D. Vance's business, none of his business at all. This is the internal affairs of American allies. It seems the example he chose on free speech was wrong. It was quickly fact-checked in the media and wrong. But it was none of his business to talk about the internal affairs of America's allies.
Changing topics, one of the more interesting elements that has been formed part of the Trump coalition has been this Make America Healthy Again campaign with Robert F.K. Jr., whatever his name is. You've been known to be quite particular about your health regime. Famously in your book, Diary of a Foreign Minister, you talked about your, quote, mission to have a concave abdomen defined by deep-cut obliques and your love of one-legged Romanian deadlifts and steel-cut oats. You're 1 year younger than Donald Trump. He doesn't seem to follow the same rigid health and diet regime as you do. Regardless of what you think about the guy politically, where do you think he gets his stamina and energy?
Yeah, no, it is remarkable. It is remarkable. He's maintained the pace over the last 4 years. He had all the burden of being effectively the opposition leader, the spokesperson for the political minority, and he maintained the pace. The rallies are remarkable. They're colossal achievements, and his strength has been based on the rallies. Don't forget, when he was chasing the nomination in 2016, everyone expected him to be done in the South Carolina primary. Well, he just did something that no one has done in memory. He turned on public meetings that were so entertaining, people rolled along, and he won the primary on the basis of his public performance. This is a major, major part of his appeal. And if he does it on a diet of hot dogs and hamburgers with ice cream sodas, then good luck to him. I don't know where that leads Robert Kennedy Jr. and what I'm sure is his concern with processed foods that figure so prominently in the diets of Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it's a legitimate issue. I always think the focus on it, which probably hasn't been given the attention it deserves in more kind of bookish, wonkish policy circles, right? It's a major issue in the United States and in Australia.
Yeah, I think Robert Kennedy would be well advised to focus on that part of the agenda, food additives, the level of salt, the levels of fat in processed American food, and to have used his clout as a member of the Trump cabinet to get the manufacturers in and say, I want you all move at the same time. These are my half dozen or so goals. And they'd begin with less sugar, less fat, especially I'm talking about the dangerous fats, not the good fats. And I think he's got a reasonable agenda there. What he's been saying about vaccinations does not appear to be evidence-based. But he had a moment when he was clearly influencing opinion. I remember 20 years ago at an Aspen Institute conference, a wide-ranging contribution by former President Bill Clinton, the early 2000s, and he said, everywhere I go around America, I find mums and dads worried about autism. And he said, we don't know what causes it. He said, maybe it is vaccinations. He just threw that out there to his audience. And I've wondered in recent times whether he might have picked that up from Robert Kennedy, who was at that time still a more acceptable figure with more entree. He wasn't seen as contentious and high risk in a way that he has been. I think if he shifts his agenda onto things that are evidence-based, he could conceivably do good.
You started off as a journalist, and you can turn a phrase, and you're known for your love of literature. Who do you think is the best writer in Australia's federal parliament today, and who is the most well-read?
I would say that politicians tend to be the best-read professional class in this country. I was always struck when I was in the federal parliament at how deeply and widely read were many of the political colleagues. I won't nominate them because that would be unfair to those I've forgotten or I never got around to talking to about books. But you can really have decent conversations, might be about Australian literature. I think they devour books on their holidays, and every book of history, I think, would have a following. I'm talking about both sides of politics, too.
Yeah. I guess there's a final question, Bob. What would you describe your political philosophy today, and how has it changed over the years?
Well, I was always, from my last year at university, I was always an anti-totalitarian. So there's never any prospect of me drifting to the left of the ALP, because back in the 70s, I would have thought they were too sympathetic to the Marxist view. I went through a phase when, after talking to European social democrats, I noticed some interest in the views of the younger Marx. But that quickly in my last visit to a bookshop, I picked up a new translation of Karl Marx's Das Kapital. And I looked at it and I thought, that I would learn more about how the modern economy works from a week reading the Wall Street Journal than struggling with this. He's predicting the fall of capitalism. He wrote it in the 19th century, and the New York Stock Exchange has kept growing, defying any expectation of a crisis of capitalism. So I was never drawn to Marx's critiques. I ended up being a social democrat, but I accept the criticism that conservatives would make. Well, you social democrats, you want more social security, and all the rest of it. That sort of defines you, a bigger role for government. At what stage do you say the government share of the economy is too big? I remember Peter Costello, back when he was a university student, putting that to me after I'd visited a campus and spoken in support of a move against the campus left. We were collaborators. But he asked that question. He said, well, you know, social democrats, what's an appropriate size of the economy to be taken over by the state? And I think that's a very tough question. So the most appealing thing about a conservative approach to me is a conservative interest in reducing, or at the very least containing, the size of the government share of the public sector, because it gets to the point, 50%, I think, in Germany and France, Scandinavia, it gets to the point where the burden of borrowing and taxation to support it is oppressive to the rest of the economy. Right now, I'm very skeptical about America's imperial role, and I think that a paranoid America obsessed with primacy could take a decision to go to war, abandon diplomacy and go to war, because their deep state has drummed into its population that war is inevitable. In other words, it'd be a little like 1914, and the condition of America leaves me very uncomfortable, and I'm the first to concede that in capturing the resistance to a dogmatic identity politics, Trump got onto something, and he's got public support.
Yeah, I'm always like to remind people that the longest serving foreign minister in the UK was the foreign minister in charge in the lead up to the First World War. So experience doesn't necessarily lead to great results, or whether he could have averted it. It's a question.
And that's a fascinating question. You can say that if the Asquith cabinet had voted not to join France, not to go to war, it would have meant most likely a fairly swift defeat for France on top of the defeat of 1870-71. But a Europe, while dominated by the imperial Germany, would have avoided Hitler. So that's an alternative history that's got to be entertained.
Yeah, it's one that people like Neil Ferguson and others have made about, but it's a complicated question, because whether they could have avoided it at that stage, it's a whole other podcast. But I've really appreciated chatting with you. Thanks for making time. If people want to buy your books or find out what you're doing these days, what's the best way of finding
Yeah, I don't. I don't have a blog. I tweet every now and then. That's a challenge for me to move and to do a bit more to get views out there. But as I've indicated, I see it as a somewhat complex place, not lent our world, and not lending itself to any simple sloganeering solutions.
Yeah. Well, I'll link to your Amazon books, because I've enjoyed them, and there's a lot shows a certain depth and hinterland to you, which sometimes people may not appreciate if they just see you in 5-second grabs on the news and stuff, we have over the years. Thanks again, and look forward to catching up in due course.
My pleasure. Good luck with the ideas.
Thanks, man. Bye.